It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for joining us this morning. We're talking about the gig economy and how workers fared during the COVID-19 pandemic. In 2020, there were roughly 59 million Americans working as part of the gig or freelancing economy, either as their main job or second and sometimes third jobs. That's according to Statista, a marketing and consumer data research firm. Well-known examples of gig workers include Uber or Lyft drivers, but the gig economy includes people who deliver takeout through apps like Grubhub, dog walkers, and more. And folks working these jobs sometimes face an uphill battle for access to benefits like sick pay. Now, are you a part of the gig economy? What has your experience been like over the last year? If you lost a job, did you turn to gig work like ride sharing to stay afloat? Did you turn to unemployment assistance as a gig worker? We want to hear from you. Call in now at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Arun Sundararajan is the Harold Price Professor of Entrepreneurship and Professor of Technology Operations and Statistics at New York University's Stern School of Business. He wrote the book, The Sharing Economy, The End of Employment and the Rise of Crowd-Based Capitalism. Arun, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Delighted to be joining. Thank you for having me.
So we've been in this pandemic for the last year and a half. What changes have you seen within the gig economy through this new lens?
Well, I think that there have been a number of both challenges and opportunities that have been created by the gig economy through the pandemic. I think the challenges have been what the pandemic has underscored is the fragility of our social safety net and the fact that a growing number of Americans do not work as full-time employees, as you pointed out, but earn all or part of their income through the gig economy. This number is somewhere in the 50 million plus. I think that MBO Partners and Emergent Research, Steve King, have excellent data on this. Now, we've had some unemployment benefits extended to these gig workers through the CARES Act and, a particular program of the CARES Act, the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance. That ends in early September. And so, that part of the social safety net that was extended to the gig economy will now be gone and we'll be back to where we were in 2019, having to create new legislation. But I think it's also highlighted how important this kind of flexibility in work arrangement is to the economy. And I'll give you an example. As we moved into lockdowns in early 2020, restaurants shut down their in-person dining and food delivery services exploded. If the platforms like DoorDash and Uber Eats had to employ every delivery person full-time, they would not have been able to scale up as rapidly as they had to. Their demand actually doubled in over the course of a quarter. And so that flexibility and that fluidity in labor supply there made it possible for a lot of people to order food during the lockdown. And this wouldn't have been possible under a more rigid employment-based labor system. And so I think it's highlighted both the importance of this kind of flexible work to the American economy, but also the fact that we've left these increasingly important workers out when designing our social safety net.
Yeah, and I want to stick with that latter point, Arun, because people who did engage in gig work, if we want to stick with, ride sharing or even food delivery right now, many of them didn't have access to sick time or unemployment insurance through their I'm going to put in quotes, employers. Do you see this now as a jumping off point to grant gig workers a little bit more of a safety net moving forward, since we've learned a lot over the last year and a half?
Absolutely, Carlisle. I think it's central that we rethink how our social safety net is funded. The United States has always chosen a path of partnership between the individual, the private sector, and the government in creating the social safety net. You know, 100 years ago, there was no social safety net to speak of. Through the Great Depression and through sort of reading books like The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, society created sort of different layers of protection, unemployment benefits, limits on how long you work, minimum wage mandates, overtime pay, programs that helped you plan for retirement, health insurance, you know, the entire bundle. But, you know, not surprisingly, over the 20th century, this was created for full-time employees, and with the expectation that there would be an employer, a private sector or government player called the employer, who would be contributing all or part of the funds for this portion of the safety net. Now, we're in the 21st century, and as you pointed out at the beginning of the show, a significant fraction of the American workforce is no longer in this full-time employment category. So they don't have that employer entity who can contribute. And because of the way the legislation is crafted, they simply don't qualify for a lot of the social safety net that we have painstakingly built over the 20th century. And so for many years, many of us have been advocating for a rethinking of how the social safety net is funded. I think with Proposition 22, which was a ballot initiative last fall being passed in California, we've gotten a first example of how a social safety net might look for non-employment work. Proposition 22 laid out a framework for the platforms like Uber and Lyft and DoorDash to start contributing towards some kind of benefits for, you know, their drivers and delivery people without making these drivers and delivery people full-time employees. And so it's not a perfect system, but it's a start. But I think one of the biggest challenges for the next couple of decades for the American workforce is creating a new funding mechanism and a new legislative underpinning for a social safety net that extends to everybody, not just full-time employees.
We are talking to Arun Sundararajan right now, business professor at NYU. We are talking about the gig economy, especially in light of the CARES Act, portions of it coming to an end that were helping gig workers who are facing unemployment or a loss of income float during the pandemic. Now, Arun, the United States reported, a record 9.3 million job openings in April. These included jobs for transportation, recreation, et cetera. How have labor shortages affected ride-sharing apps like Uber or Lyft?
I think we've seen a steady increase in prices as a consequence of the labor shortages that these apps have faced. And what I think happened is over 2020, most of the country was in lockdown, people weren't traveling, people were not commuting to work or going out. The demand for ride-sharing apps dropped dramatically. And as a consequence, there wasn't much work for people who drove for Lyft and Uber. These people then went on to look for alternative ways to earn money. They were delivering for DoorDash and Uber Eats. Perhaps they pursued other income generating opportunities. Some of them collected unemployment benefits, no doubt. But now, as the economy is roaring back, as people are out, as travel has picked up again, the number of drivers for Uber and Lyft that Uber and Lyft need hasn't matched the increase in demand. And what Uber and Lyft do when their supply is lower than demand is that they raise prices to try and pull in drivers. But partly because of the CARES Act, and partly because a lot of individuals might have just found other ways to earn a living and might say, well, I don't want to go back to driving for Lyft and Uber. This return of drivers has been slow. And so what we're left with is higher prices, actually, especially at a time where rideshare is an increasingly important part of the public transportation infrastructure because people are still hesitant to use mass transit in cities like New York.
We are talking about workers in the gig economy with Arun Sundararajan, a professor of business at New York University, and you can join the conversation. What do you think about the gig economy? What do you think about companies like Uber or Grubhub? What do you think those companies owe to the people that work for them? We want to hear from you, especially if you are part of the gig economy. Call 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our conversation about the gig economy, from the people who work freelance jobs to how the pandemic affected their livelihoods. Our guest is Arun Sundararajan, business professor at New York University, and we are taking your calls right now at 800-642-1234. If you are part of the gig economy, maybe you drive for Uber or Lyft, or maybe you deliver groceries, we want to hear from you. Again, that number is 800 642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. And I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Sandy from Mineral Point. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So my question is, I'm a gig worker, and I lost my contract not due to COVID, and I could never get an answer on if I could have gotten benefits through the CARES Act, even though it wasn't my loss of contract, wasn't COVID related.
Sure. Sandy, thank you for that call. Arun, you know, was there confusion about who qualified for this and not?
Absolutely. I think that there was confusion both at the individual level. I mean, a lot of people like Sandy weren't sure whether they qualified or not. There was also confusion at the administrative level. I think a lot of local government systems have been administering the unemployment compensation and the unemployment assistance. And so I believe that, you know, if Sandy is a gig, Sandy, if you're a gig worker, you know, and even though you don't qualify for other types of, you know, unemployment insurance, typically, during the pandemic, even if your loss of work was not COVID related, the CARES Act should have supported you. If you could not work either due to child or dependent care needs, or if you were simply self-employed, a freelancer, a gig worker, or a part-time worker.
Sandy, thank you again for that call. Now, Arun, let's look at some of the nitty gritty of these gig workers. You know, Uber drivers and Grubhub delivery workers, for the most part, are not considered employees by those companies. They're considered, for the most part, independent contractors. How have states challenged their classification or work status?
Well, we've seen for the last at least 6 years, a number of efforts by states largely to try and classify Uber drivers and Grubhub and DoorDash and Postmates delivery people as employees. And I think that this effort by different states, I think California's has been sort of the most visible and the most contentious. And the intention of the states is good. They want to come up with a way to extend the safety net to the people who drive for Uber and Lyft and who deliver for the food delivery platforms. But in my opinion, they're going about it the wrong way. The legislators are saying, hey, we've already got this safety net set up. Let's just put the drivers and delivery people in the employment buckets, and that way they qualify for the safety net. While what they should be doing is recognizing that some people drive 5 hours a week, some people drive 10 hours a week, some people drive in the summer but not in the fall. Some people have multiple sort of gigs that they are pursuing, including driving and delivering. And so they don't fit neatly into the employment bucket. And the legislators should be taking on the harder task of saying, well, how do we refashion the safety net? How do we refashion the funding? So California famously passed legislation called AB 5, Assembly Bill 5, that classified Uber drivers and Grubhub delivery people as employees. The platforms challenged this. They fought in court for a while. And finally, the ballot initiative, Proposition 22, settled the issue, reaffirmed that the drivers and the deliverers were not employees, but simultaneously created a funding mechanism for these independent contractors to get some benefits funded partly by the platforms. And that's the kind of solution we want. So Massachusetts is midway through this process. I've participated in conversations with the New York legislatures, New York state legislatures, although we've been busy with other things for the last couple of years. But, you know, back in 2019, I think some momentum was building to create a safety net funding mechanism for gig workers. And I'm optimistic that once the dust settles here, we will go back to that important task. But yeah, I mean, you know, to put it briefly, the states have good intentions, but they're trying to sort of fit a 21st century work arrangement into a 20th century social safety net. And they have to sort of, you know, be more creative and be more ambitious in their efforts to help gig workers, because in 20 years, a vast majority of the American workforce are going to be working as gig workers, not as full-time employees.
Arun Sundararajan is our guest right now, business professor at New York University. We are talking about the gig economy as it is right now and what it might look like in the future. So Arun, let's look at the big picture. You're saying that we need to wildly rethink how we're doing this. What are some ways you see maybe big ideas being put into place here if we don't want to just push gig workers into an old model? What do you think could actually work?
The solution is definitely going to be some form of public-private partnership, Carlisle. You know, I don't see us as a country moving to a Scandinavian kind of model where the government is funding benefits on its own for everybody and tax rates are really high. And so I think an instructive, you know, transition that we might look at is the evolution of retirement programs over the 20th century. You know, 40 or 50 years ago, a number of companies would offer their full-time employees pensions after the employees retired. And so a company like General Motors would continue to pay its workers even after the workers retired through a pension plan. It became clear in the 1980s and 90s that this wasn't financially tenable for a lot of companies to continue to pay workers after the workers retired. And so a lot of companies embraced 401k plans, which is a partnership. The government is saying, well, here is the tax infrastructure and the tax breaks to the company and the individual for planning for the future. So here's an incentive. The company contributes some money, the individual contributes some money. And so we create the same pension plan pool of money for the, you know, potential retirees. It's just done with a different mechanism. And so what we need to do is to create funding mechanisms or ways of funding health insurance, unemployment, that have the platforms participating, have the workers themselves participating. But it really all starts with the government, with state governments and federal governments saying, here are new structures, like earned income tax credit, like, you know, the 401k system, that give the platforms and the individuals incentives and, you know, sort of a reason to contribute to this pool of money. And so, you know, I wish there was sort of some, you know, magical big idea that would solve the problem, but it really has to do with generating the dollars, right? and who's going to generate the dollars. And it's either the person themselves, the company, or the government. And for us, Carlisle, I think it's got to be some combination of the three.
And with we just have 10 seconds, are you hopeful that we could see a change?
I really am. You know, I think that there's a lot of momentum. What Uber and Lyft have done is raise the plight of gig workers to the national stage. The press is now interested in the fact that gig workers don't have a social safety net. This has been a problem for many decades, but because it's Uber now, everybody's paying attention. So I think the time is right to refashion our social safety net.
Well, Arun, we'll leave
and
it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Arun Sundararajan is a professor at New York University's Stern School of Business. He wrote the book, The Sharing Economy, The End of Employment and the Rise of Crowd-Based Capitalism. Coming up, we'll talk about the mink industry in Wisconsin. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg talking with the author of a new biography on Milwaukee Bucks superstar Giannis Antetokounmpo. It was released yesterday.
The Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions for the first time in 50 years.
It's over. The Bucks have done it. The long wait has ended. After a half century, the Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions once again.
And Giannis Antetokounmpo is the superstar at the heart of the team. Not only does he have a national championship and two MVP trophies under his belt, but there's also a new biography on him. I recently talked with the author of Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. It's about Antetokounmpo's Greek upbringing and his journey to American basketball stardom.
My name is Miren Fader, and I'm a staff writer at The Ringer.
Fader says Antetokounmpo was born in Sapolia, a neighborhood of Athens, Greece. She says life was tough. His parents had migrated from Nigeria and they were undocumented, so finding work was hard.
So the parents would then bring the kids to sell items on the street or at upscale beaches and try to do whatever they could to put food on the table. And, you know, oftentimes they just wouldn't eat. So it was really, really tough. However, there was a lot of joy as well.
Antetokounmpo started playing basketball at age 13. He couldn't play on the elite local teams because of his immigration status, but some NBA scouts started to take notice anyway. By 2013, an 18-year-old Antetokounmpo was a scrawny but intriguing outsider as the NBA draft approached.
So the Milwaukee Bucks are choosing at number 15, and they decide to take a swing because it's Milwaukee.
With the 15th pick in the 2013 NBA draft, the Milwaukee Bucks select Giannis Antetokounmpo.
And you hope to get lucky, but you expect disappointment. You don't know if this Greek kid is going to work out, but he's really tall and he's charismatic and maybe he might be okay.
Antetokounmpo ended up being more than just okay. And Milwaukee was a great fit because the team allowed him time to get acclimated to life in the NBA and the U.S.
And not having the pressure of coming in, being deified as the superstar, enabled him to grow. The only pressure that Giannis felt was, how do I provide money for my family? How do I get my family to come to America? You know, his pressures were different than the average NBA rookie.
Fader says taking care of his family was so important to Antetokounmpo because of how tight-knit they had always been.
Giannis grew up watching how his dad would pretend he wasn't hungry and give his portions to his sons. And Giannis's brothers were his best friends, his comrades. They were always laughing. They always shared everything. There was no arguments because everything was communal.
The love that Antetokounmpo had for his family was on display in 2019 when he got emotional while accepting his first MVP award. He also thanked his teammates that night and the city of Milwaukee.
And I think the thing that endears fans to Giannis most and Giannis to this city is that these fans watched him grow up. They liked that he wasn't crowned king at age 13. And they liked that this came out of nowhere. That's the ultimate lesson of all from people that come from Milwaukee. You work hard and dream big. And Giannis has done that.
And now Antetokounmpo has two MVPs and a championship. And he signed a contract extension, so his future is in Milwaukee. So what does Fader think that future might look like?
Keep in mind, Giannis is 26 years old, and he is just beginning to mature, not just into a global basketball superstar, but into a man, a father. And I think we're going to see him use his platform and his voice in bigger ways beyond the basketball court. I think Giannis is primed to become more. I think he's going to share more of himself.
Miran Fader is a staff writer at The Ringer and the author of Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. And if you couldn't get enough of that Giannis Wisconsin Life, Miran Fader will join us on the morning show next week to talk about her book, Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. That's next Wednesday. That's August 18th at 8 a.m. Right now, Wisconsin is the leading producer of mink pelts in the United States, and the state leads the nation in the breeding of female mink. That's according to the USDA. Harvesting and selling mink fur is technically Wisconsin's oldest industry, with French settlers starting the fur trade in the 17th century. But the industry is facing a decline between a drop in domestic demand, trade issues with China, and more. And while the mink industry hopes to rebound, animal rights advocates hope that this signals a decline in the fur industry as a whole. And we want to hear from you. Are you a mink producer or do you work on a mink farm? How has your farm been doing during the pandemic? Have you faced overproduction at all in the last year? And what do you think about the state of the industry? Call 800-642-1234 or you can email ideas at WPR.org. Joining us now to talk about the state's mink industry is Dr. John Easley. He's a Sheboygan County veteran and Director of Research for Fur Commission USA. That's a nonprofit trade organization representing U.S. mink farmers. Dr. Easley, welcome to the morning show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So there has been a significant drop, certainly over the last year. What is to blame here for the drop in mink production?
Well, primarily it's due to the economic conditions that the industry is under at this point. There was an oversupply of mink pelts 4 or 5 years ago, and that caused the market to be depressed over these last few years, and the industry is just reacting to that situation now.
And can you talk a little bit about the price of the crop over the last few years? We can look at last year. It looks like there was a drop compared to 2019. Can you talk a little bit about the price of the crop?
Yeah, it just reflects the oversupply. The primary demand comes from countries outside the U.S., China, South Korea, Russia, Turkey, Greece, and there was an oversupply of product available, so that just depressed the price to the point that some producers decided that over the last few years that they would not continue to produce pelts anymore.
Now, you work with mink ranchers throughout Wisconsin. What have you heard from them about the state of the industry from their perspective?
Well, yeah, so it's been very challenging the last 3 years, but due to the change in the amount of production worldwide over the last year, prices are starting to rebound and come up to make it profitable again for the producers to continue to produce pelts. And so they are looking forward to being able to work with their livestock and continue family traditions.
We are talking with Dr. John Easley. He's a veterinarian and he's a consultant for the mink industry here in Wisconsin. And you talked a little bit just a second ago about, you know, that this is a family business. How long have some of these mink farms been established in Wisconsin?
Yeah, at least three generations that I know of. There's quite a history in Wisconsin of mink farming and pelt production going back to the 40s and 50s. So it's quite established here. There was a large number of farms back in those times. Slowly with just like the rest of animal agriculture, when times get tougher, farms consolidate, get a little bit larger, and that's what we've seen in the mink industry also. So it reflects the normal progress that we see in animal agriculture.
Just a moment ago, you were also talking about how Wisconsin exports mink pelts largely abroad. And, you know, the United States and China have had an ongoing trade conflict. You know, the trade deficit with China, you know, went down by 19% in 2019. You know, how is that impacting the mink industry's bottom line in Wisconsin?
Well, I don't know if it has a major effect in itself. Certainly, anytime there's trade restrictions, it impacts all products. But the mink industry and the utilization of fur in China is a relatively small industry, but it's well utilized there. So there hasn't been a lot of impingements put upon the importation at this point, but hopefully demand will continue there, and thusly there'll be demand for the product that's being produced.
Our mink expert this morning is Dr. John Easley. He's a researcher with the Fur Commission USA. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the mink industry? What thoughts do you have overall about fur in general? Call in now, 800-642-1234. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our conversation about the mink fur industry in Wisconsin. In 2020, the state's pelt output dropped about 60% compared to 2019, and the value of those pelts dropped by about 19%. Our guest right now is Dr. John Easley. He's a veterinarian based in Sheboygan County, and he's also a consultant with Fur Commission USA. That's a nonprofit trade organization representing mink ranchers and farmers and all that. And we want to hear from you. Retailers, do you sell fur or mink at your place of business? Maybe you purchase it for your own personal enjoyment. What questions do you have about the mink industry? Call 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. And I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Eric in Green Bay. Hi, Eric.
Hi. I was just wondering exactly, is there any other use other than just the pelts from the animal? Do they get anything else out of it for sale to other countries? Do they, like the meat, do they get anything else out of it?
Eric, thank you for that call. Dr. Easley, tell us more.
Yeah, yes, there is. The carcasses after the pelt has been processed and can be utilized for protein meals that are produced depending on the area of the production. They can be utilized for other things. They are then rendered. Mink oil is used in a lot of different processes, for different products. So that's a big byproduct also. But those are, yeah, those are the main things that are utilized. The pelt, the mink quail itself, and then the carcasses are rendered and then used for a protein meal.
Eric, thank you so much for that call. And Dr. Easley, I want to just switch gears a little bit because we've been in a pandemic for the last year. Mink to human transmission of COVID-19 has been reported in Denmark, the Netherlands, and in Michigan. We don't have any documented cases here in Wisconsin, but how are mink being affected by the virus on farms in the state?
Well, yeah, it's a major concern for the industry, and we've been addressing that in collaboration with USDA and the CDC to understand the disease itself. Mink, like people, are very susceptible to this virus. We've worked to develop biosecurity protocols for the farms and for the people being involved on the mink farms, in collaboration with CDC and USDA. And then we've also worked in collaboration with the largest animal health company in the world, plus two other companies to produce vaccines that will help protect the mink from this virus. And those vaccines are being utilized this summer. It was a great effort by the company producing the vaccine to be able to get it all tested correctly, like they did with the human vaccines, and then be able to produce enough vaccine to be able to have it available for the great majority of our farms to inoculate their mink. And it's very very much analogous to what's being utilized in the human population for most cases. It's a two-shot protocol. About 3 weeks apart, and hopefully that will, along with the biosecurity, again, just like we're doing in the human population, to help prevent infection in the mink farms.
And you're a veterinarian, and you've been going out to administer some of these vaccines. What has that experience been like?
Well, I don't administer the vaccines. I've helped establish the ability for the producers to purchase the vaccines and to get it developed through this last 9 months. The producers vaccinate the animals themselves, which is pretty typical for most animal agriculture.
Yeah, thank you for that clarification. We are talking to Dr. John Easley right now. He's a Wisconsin veterinarian and a mink production consultant. And I want to go back to our callers right now. We have Carlito in Madison. Hi, Carlito.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, what did you want to ask about?
I'm kind of conflicted. We used to have a ferret. Ferrets being the cousins of minks, you sort of become sympathetic to the mink. Badgers being our state mascot and the wolverine, its cousin being the Michigan mascot, I find these animals not just intriguing but adorable. I also find cows adorable, but we eat the men and we drink the milk from the cows. How do we reconcile these feelings in our heart for these precious creatures of God and still sustain our families? How does one have generations of mink farming and put that together in their heart?
Carlito, thank you for that call. Dr. Easley, what is your response?
Well, and that's great they have the compassion for these animals and all animals in general. But again, we are trying to utilize these animals for not only for their pelts, but also, like I stated before, for other products that we can utilize. So we try not to to waste anything that's being produced. Again, the great majority of these mink are being produced on family farms. They're very good animal caretakers. They enjoy working with the animals. They think highly of them and try to raise them in the best environment that they can. from that standpoint, the Fur Commission USA sponsors a tremendous amount of research to understand the best way to manage these animals and give them the best environment and the best situation for us to raise them in so that they thrive in that environment. We have been selecting these animals from a breed standpoint, a breeding standpoint, genetically, to be able to thrive in these management situations that we have them in, just like the rest of animal agriculture. So, again, we're trying to do the best we can, you know, for this livestock that we're raising. And it is a part of animal agriculture. It's just another commodity that we are being able to derive from the use of animals. And certainly there is, a major effort put forth to understand these animals and make sure that we are raising them in the best environment that we can and handling them that way. We have herd certification programs that are in place that are third-party verified, that the farms have to meet a very strict set of protocols. They're certified by PACO, a certification process for all welfare programs. So I think the industry is doing as well and really better than a lot of other animal agricultural products that we're utilizing. We've had herd certification processes in place since 1985.
And Dr. Easley, I want to go back to a point you made just a little bit ago about how mink are used, the whole mink. And you had said something about that the mink meat, the carcass was used for protein meals. Can you explain really quickly, is that for animal feed or is that for human consumption?
Well, that would be for animal feed. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for that. Let's go to one of our callers really quickly right now. We have Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. Hi. I was wondering if there are any designers or manufacturers of mink clothing in the state. I guess you call them furriers.
Kenneth, thank you for that call. Dr. Easley, we don't have a ton of time left, but who is maybe working with this product in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I'm not fully versed in that part of the industry, but yeah, there are multiple furriers still in Wisconsin and in the neighboring states, Chicago. So yeah, there is a small but active manufacturing portion still in the states here, but the majority of it is done overseas.
Dr. Easley, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Dr. John Easley is a Sheboygan County veterinarian and director of research for Fur Commission USA. That's a group that advocates for the fur industry. Just ahead, we dive into Lake Michigan to visit a shipwreck sanctuary. An expert explains the pivotal role this archaeological site has in our state's history. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.